"I'll have to send Aloysius a message saying to expect you," said Charlotte, picking up her pen. She paused and looked up at them all. "Is this a dreadful idea? I feel it as if I cannot be sure."
Tessa looked at her worriedly. Seeing Charlotte like this, doubting her own instincts, made her hate Benedict Lightwood and his cohorts even more than she already did. It was Henry who stepped up and put a gentle hand on his wife's shoulder.
"The only alternative seems to be doing nothing, dearest Charlotte," he said. "And doing nothing, I find, rarely accomplishes anything. Besides, what could go wrong?" "Oh, by the angel, I wish you hadn't asked that," replied Charlotte with fervor. But she bent over the paper and began to write.
That afternoon was Tessa's and Sophie's second training session with the Lightwoods. Having changed into her gear, Tessa left her room to find Sophie waiting for her in the corridor. She was dressed to train as well, her hair knotted up expertly behind her head and a dark expression on her face.
"Sophie, what is it?" Tessa inquired, falling into step beside the other girl. "You look quite out of countenance."
"Well, if you must know..."
Sophie dropped her voice.
"It's Bridget."
"Bridget?" The Irish girl had been nearly invisible in the kitchen since she'd arrived, unlike Cyril, who had been here and there about the house, doing errands like Sophie. The last memory Tessa had of Bridget involved her sitting atop Gabriel Lightwood with a knife. She let herself dwell on it pleasantly for a moment.
"What's she done?"
"She just..."
Sophie let out a gusty sigh.
"She isn't very amiable. Agatha was my friend. But Bridget, well, we have a way of talking, among our servants, you know, usually, but Bridget just won't. Cyril's friendly enough, but Bridget just keeps to herself in the kitchen, singing those awful Irish ballads of hers. I'd wager she's singing one now."
They were passing not far from the scullery door. Sophie gestured for Tessa to follow her, and together they crept close and peered inside. The scullery was quite large, with doors leading off to the kitchen and pantry. The sideboard was piled with food meant for dinner, fish and vegetables, lately cleaned and prepared. Bridget stood at the sink. Her hair standing out around her head in wild red curls, made frizzy by the humidity of the water. She was singing, too. Sophie had been quite right about that. Her voice drifting over the sound of the water was high and sweet.
"Oh, her father led her down the stair. Her mother combed her yellow hair. Her sister Anne led her to the cross, and her brother John set her on her horse. Now you are high and I am low. Give me a kiss before ye go." She leaned down to give him a kiss. He gave her a deep wound and did not miss. And with a knife as sharp as a dart, her brother stabbed her to the heart."
Nate's face flashed in front of Tessa's eyes, and she shuddered. Sophie, looking past her, didn't seem to notice.
"That's all she sings about," she whispered. "Murder and betrayal, blood and pain, it's horrid."
Mercifully, Sophie's voice covered the end of the song. Bridget had begun drying dishes and started up with a new ballad, the tune even more melancholy than the first.
"Why does your sword so drip with blood, Edward, Edward? Why does your sword so drip with blood? And why so sad are ye?"
Enough of this!
Sophie turned and began hurrying down the hall. Tessa followed.
You do see what I meant, though. She's so dreadfully morbid, and it's awful sharing a room with her. She never says a word in the morning or at night, just moans.
Share a room with her? Tessa was astonished. But the Institute has so many rooms.
For visiting shadow hunters,
Sophie said.
Not for servants.
She spoke matter-of-factly, as if it would never have occurred to her to question or complain about the fact that dozens of grand rooms stood empty while she shared a room with Bridget, singer of murderous ballads.
I could talk to Charlotte, Tessa began. Oh, no, please don't.
They had reached the door to the training room. Sophie turned to her, all distress.
I wouldn't want her to think I've been complaining about the other servants. I really wouldn't, Miss Tessa.
Tessa was about to assure the other girl that she would say nothing to Charlotte if that was what Sophie really wanted, when she heard raised voices from the other side of the training room door. Gesturing at Sophie to be quiet, she leaned in and listened. The voices were quite clearly those of the Lightwood brothers. She recognized Gideon's lower, rougher tones as he said,
There will be a moment of reckoning, Gabriel. You can depend upon it. What will matter is where we stand when it comes.
Gabriel replied, his voice tense.
We will stand with Father, of course. Where else?
There was a pause. Then,
You don't know everything about him, Gabriel. You don't know all that he has done. I know that we are Lightwoods, and that he is our father. I know he fully expected to be named head of the Institute when Granville Fairchild died. Maybe the Consul knows more about him than you do, and more about Charlotte Branwell. She isn't the fool you think she is. Really?
Gabriel's voice was a sneer.
Letting us come here to train her precious girls, doesn't that make her a fool? Shouldn't she have assumed we'd be spying for her father?
Sophie and Tessa looked at each other with round eyes.
She agreed to it because the Consul forced her hand. And besides, we are met at the door here, escorted to this room and escorted out. And Miss Collins and Miss Gray know nothing of import. What damage is our presence here really doing her, would you say?
There was a silence through which Tessa could almost hear Gabriel sulking. At last he said,
If you despise Father so much, why did you ever come back from Spain?
Gideon replied, sounding exasperated.
I came back for you.
Sophie and Tessa had been leaning against the door, ears pressed to the wood. At that moment, the door gave way and swung open. Both straightened hastily, Tessa hoping that no evidence of their eavesdropping appeared on their faces. Gabriel and Gideon were standing in a patch of light at the center of the room, facing off against each other. Tessa noticed something she had not noticed before. Gabriel, despite being the younger brother, was lankily taller than Gideon by some inches. Gideon was more muscular, broader through the shoulders. He swept a hand through his sandy hair, nodding curtly to the girls as they appeared in the doorway.
Good day.
Gabriel Lightwood strode across the room to meet them. He really was quite tall, Tessa thought, craning her neck to look up at him. As a tall girl herself, she didn't often find herself bending her head back to look up at men, though both Will and Jem were taller than she was.
Miss Lovelace still regrettably absent?
He inquired, without bothering to greet them. His face was calm, the only sign of his earlier agitation a pulse hammering just beneath a courage in combat rune inked upon his throat.
She continues to have headaches, said Tessa, following him into the training room. We don't know how long she'll be indisposed.
Until these training sessions are over, I suspect, said Gideon,
so dryly that Tessa was surprised when Sophie laughed. Sophie immediately composed her features again, but not before Gideon had given her a surprised, almost appreciative glance, as if he weren't used to having his jokes laughed at. With a sigh, Gabriel reached up and freed two long sticks from their holsters on the wall. He handed one to Tessa.
Today, he began, We shall be working on parrying and blocking.
As usual, Tessa lay awake a long time that night before sleep began to come. Nightmares had plagued her recently, usually of Mortmain, his cold grey eyes, and his colder voice saying measuredly that he had made her, that there is no Tessa Grey. She had come face to face with him, the man they sought, and still she did not really know what he wanted from her. To marry her? But why? To claim her power? The thought of his cold, lizard-like eyes on her made her shiver. The thought that he might have had something to do with her birth was even worse. She did not think anyone, not even Jem, wonderful, understanding Jem, quite understood her burning need to know what she was, or the fear that she was some sort of a monster, a fear that woke her in the middle of the night, leaving her gasping and clawing at her own skin, as if she could peel it away to reveal a devil's hide beneath. Just then, she heard a rustle at the door, and the faint scratch of something being gently pushed against it. After a moment's pause, she slid off the bed and padded across the room. She eased the door open to find an empty corridor, the faint sound of violin music drifting from Jem's room across the hall. At her feet was a small green book. She picked it up and gazed at the words stamped in gold on its spine, Vatek, by William Beckford. She shut the door behind her and carried the book over to her bed, sitting down so she could examine it. Will must have left it for her. Obviously it could be no one else, but why? Why these odd, small kindnesses in the dark, the talk about books, and the coldness the rest of the time? She opened the book to its title page. Will had scrawled a note for her there. Not just a note, in fact. A poem. For Tessa Grey, on the occasion of being given a copy of Vatek to read. Caliph Vatek and his dark horde are bound for hell, you won't be bored. Your faith in me will be restored, unless this token you find untoward. And my poor gift you have ignored. Will. Tessa burst out laughing, then clapped a hand over her mouth. Drat Will, for always being able to make her laugh. Even when she didn't want to. Even when she knew that opening her heart to him, even an inch, was like taking a pinch of some deadly addictive drug. She dropped the copy of Vatek, complete with Will's deliberately terrible poem, onto her nightstand, rolled onto the bed, burying her face in the pillows. She could still hear Jem's violin music, sweetly sad, drifting beneath the door. As hard as she could, she tried to push thoughts of Will out of her mind, and indeed, when she fell asleep at last and dreamed, for once, he made no appearance.
It rained the next day, and despite her umbrella, Tessa could feel the fine hat she had borrowed from Jessamine beginning to sag, like a waterlogged bird around her ears as they, she, Jem, Will, and Cyril, carrying their luggage, hurried from the coach into King's Cross Station. Through the sheets of grey rain, she was conscious only of a tall, imposing building, a great clock tower rising from the front. It was topped with a weathercock that showed that the wind was blowing due north, and not gently, spattering drops of cold rain into her face. Inside, the station was chaos, people hurrying hither and thither, newspaper boys hawking their wares, men striding up and down with sandwich boards strapped to their chests, advertising everything from hair tonic to soap. A little boy in a Norfolk jacket dashed to and fro, his mother in hot pursuit. With a word to Jem, Will vanished immediately into the crowd. "Gone off and left us, has he?" said Tessa, struggling with her umbrella, which was refusing to close. "Let me do that." Deftly, Jem reached over and flicked at the mechanism. The umbrella shut with a decided snap. Pushing her damp hair out of her eyes, Tessa smiled at him, just as Will returned with an aggrieved-looking porter, who relieved Cyril of the baggage and snapped at them to hurry up. The train wouldn't wait all day. Will looked from the porter to Jem's cane and back. His blue eyes narrowed. "It will wait for us," Will said, with a deadly smile. The porter looked bewildered, but said, "Sir, in a decidedly less aggressive tone, and proceeded to lead them toward the departure platform.
People, so many people, streamed around Tessa as she made her way through the crowd, clutching at Jem with one hand and Jessamine's hat with the other. Far at the end of the station, where the tracks ran out into open ground, she could see the steel-gray sky smudged with soot.
Jem helped her up into their compartment. There was much bustling about the luggage, and Will tipping the porter, in among shouts and whistling as the train prepared to depart. The door swung shut behind them just as the train pulled forward, steam rushing past the windows in white drifts, wheels clacking merrily.
"Did you bring anything to read on the journey?" asked Will, settling into the seat opposite Tessa.
Jem was beside her, his cane leaning up against the wall.
She thought of the copy of Vatek and his poem in it. She had left it at the Institute to avoid temptation, the way you might leave behind a box of candies if you were banting and didn't want to put on weight.
"No," she said, "I haven't come across anything I particularly wanted to read lately."
Will's jaw set, but he said nothing.
"There's always something so exciting about the start of a journey, don't you think?" Tessa went on, nose to the window, though she could see little but smoke and soot and hurtling gray rain. London was a dim shadow in the mist.
"No," said Will, as he sat back and pulled his hat down over his eyes.
Tessa kept her face against the glass as the gray of London began to fall away behind them, and with it the rain. Soon, they were rolling through green fields dotted with white sheep, with here and there the point of a village steeple in the distance. The sky had turned from steel to a damp, misty blue, and small black clouds scudded overhead. Tessa watched it all with fascination.
"Haven't you ever been in the countryside before?" asked Jem,
though unlike Will's, his question had the flavor of actual curiosity. Tessa shook her head. "I don't remember ever leaving New York, except to go to Coney Island, and that isn't really countryside. I suppose I must have passed through some of it when I came from Southampton with the Dark Sisters, but it was dark, and they kept the curtains across the windows besides." She took off her hat, which was dripping water, and laid it on the seat between them to dry.
"But I feel as if I have seen it before, in books. I keep imagining I'll see Thornfield Hall rising up beyond the trees, or Wuthering Heights perched on a stony crag."
"Wuthering Heights is in Yorkshire," said Will from under his hat. "And we're nowhere near Yorkshire yet. We haven't even reached Grantham, and there's nothing that impressive about Yorkshire. Hills and dales, no proper mountains like we have in Wales."
"Do you miss Wales?" Tessa inquired. She wasn't sure why she did it. She knew asking Will about his past was like poking a dog with a sore tail, but she couldn't seem to help it.
Will shrugged lightly.
"What's to miss? Sheep and singing," he said. "And the ridiculous language. Verhofu ne vod mor vetu vutai itim u govio vuenu."
"What does that mean?"
"It means, I wish to get so drunk I no longer remember my own name."
"Quite useful." "You don't sound very patriotic," observed Tessa. "Weren't you just reminiscing about the mountains?"
"Patriotic?" Will looked smug. "I'll tell you what's patriotic," he said. "In honor of my birthplace, I've the Dragon of Wales tattooed on my..."
"You're in a charming temper, aren't you, William?"
interrupted Jem, though there was no edge to his voice. Still, having observed them now for some time, together and apart, Tessa knew it meant something when they called each other by their full first names instead of the familiar shortened forms.
"Remember, Sarkweather can't stand Charlotte, so if this is the mood you're in..."
"I promise to charm the dickens out of him," said Will,
sitting up and readjusting his crushed hat.
"I shall charm him with such force that when I am done, he will be left lying limply on the ground, trying to remember his own name."
"The man's 89, muttered Jem.
He may well have that problem anyway.
I suppose you're storing up all that charm now, Tessa inquired. Wouldn't want to waste any of it on us.
That's it exactly,
Will sounded pleased.
And it isn't Charlotte the Starkweathers can't stand, Jem. It's her father. Sins of the fathers, said Jem. They're not inclined to like any fair child, or anyone associated with one. Charlotte wouldn't even let Henry come up. That is because every time one lets Henry out of the house on his own, one risks an international incident, said Will. But, yes, to answer your unasked question, I do understand the trust Charlotte has placed in us, and I do intend to behave myself. I don't want to see that squinty-eyed Benedict Lightwood and his hideous sons in charge of the Institute any more than anyone else does.
They're not hideous, said Tessa. Will blinked at her.
What?
Gideon and Gabriel, said Tessa. They're really quite good-looking, not hideous at all.
I spoke, said Will in sepulchral tones, of the pitch-black inner depths of their souls.
Tessa snorted. And what color do you suppose the inner depths of your soul are, Will Herondale?
Mauve, said Will.
Tessa looked over at Jem for help, but he only smiled.
Perhaps we should discuss strategy, he said. Starkweather hates Charlotte, but knows that she sent us, so how to worm our way into his good graces?
Tessa can utilize her feminine wiles, said Will. Charlotte said he enjoys a pretty face.
How did Charlotte explain my presence? Tessa inquired, realizing belatedly that she should have asked this earlier.
She didn't really. She just gave our names.
She was quite curt, said Will.
I think it falls to us to concoct a plausible story.
We can't say I'm a shadow hunter. He'll know immediately that I'm not. No marks.
And no warlock mark. He'll think she's a mundane, said Jem. She could change, but...
Will eyed her speculatively. Though Tessa knew it meant nothing, worse than nothing, really, she still felt his gaze on her, like the brush of a finger across the back of her neck, making her shiver. She forced herself to return his look stonily.
Perhaps we could say she's a mad maiden aunt who insists on chaperoning us everywhere.
My aunt or yours? Jem inquired.
Yes, she doesn't really look like either of us, does she?
Perhaps she's a girl who's fallen madly in love with me and persists in following me wherever I go.
My talent is shape-shifting, Will, not acting, said Tessa. And at that, Jem laughed out loud. Will glared at him.
Shit better of you there, Will, he said.
It does happen sometimes, doesn't it?
Perhaps I should introduce Tessa as my fiancée. We can tell mad old Aloysius that her ascension is underway.
Ascension? Tessa remembered nothing of the term from the Codex.
Jem said, when a shadow hunter wishes to marry a mundane.
But I thought that was forbidden, Tessa asked, as the train slid into a tunnel.
It was dark suddenly in their compartment, though she had the feeling, nevertheless, that Will was looking at her, that shivering sense that his gaze was on her somehow.
It is, unless the mortal cup is used to turn that mundane into a shadow hunter. It is not a common result, but it does happen. If the shadow hunter in question applies to the Clave for an ascension for their partner, the Clave is required to consider it for at least 3 months. Meanwhile, the mundane embarks on a course of study to learn about shadow hunter culture.
Jem's voice was drowned out by the train whistle as the locomotive emerged from the tunnel. Tessa looked at Will, but he was staring fixedly out the window, not looking at her at all. She must have imagined it.
It's not a bad idea, I suppose, said Tessa. I do know rather a lot. I've finished nearly all of the Codex.
It would seem reasonable that I brought you with me, said Jem. As a possible ascender, you might want to learn about Institute, other than the one in London.
He turned to Will. What do you think?
It seems as fine an idea as any.
Will was still looking out the window. The countryside had grown less green, more stark. There were no villages visible, only long swathes of grey-green grass and outcroppings of black rock.
How many institutes are there, other than the one in London? Tessa asked.
Jem ticked them off on his hands.
In Britain? London? York? One in Cornwall, near Tintagel? One in Cardiff, and one in Edinburgh? They're all smaller, though, and report to the London Institute, which in turn reports to Idris.
Gideon Lightwood said he was at the Institute in Madrid. What on earth was he doing there?
Faffing about, most likely, said Will. Once we finish our training at 18, said Jem, as if Will hadn't spoken, we're encouraged to travel, to spend time at other institutes, to experience something of Shadowhunter culture in new places. There are always different techniques, local tricks to be learned. Gideon was away for only a few months. If Benedict called him back so soon, he must think that his acquisition of the Institute is assured.
Jem looked troubled.
But he's wrong, Tessa said firmly. And when the troubled look didn't leave Jem's grey eyes, she cast about for something to change the subject. Where is the Institute in New York?
We haven't memorized all their addresses, Tessa.
There was something in Will's voice, a dangerous undercurrent. Jem looked at him narrowly and said, Is everything all right?
Will took his hat off and laid it on the seat next to him. He looked at them both steadily for a moment, his gaze level. He was beautiful to look at, as always, Tessa thought, but there seemed something grey about him, almost faded. For someone who so often seemed to burn very brightly, that light in him seemed exhausted now, as if he had been rolling a rock up a hill, like Sisyphus.
Too much to drink last night, he said finally. Really? Why do you bother, Will? Don't you realize we both know you're lying?
Tessa almost said, but one look at Jem stopped her.
His gaze as he regarded Will was worried, very worried indeed. Though Tessa knew he did not believe Will about the drinking any more than she did, but...
Well, was all he said, lightly. If only there were a rune of sobriety.
Yes. Will looked back at him, and the strain in his expression relaxed slightly.
If we might return to discussing your plan, James. It's a good one, save one thing.
He leaned forward.
If she is meant to be affianced to you, Tessa will need a ring. I had thought of that, said Jem, startling Tessa, who had imagined he had come up with this ascendant idea on the spot.
He slipped his hand into his waistcoat pocket and drew out a silver ring, which he held out to Tessa on his palm. It was not unlike the silver ring Will often wore, though where Will's had a design of birds in flight, this one had a careful etching of the crenellations of a castle tower around it.
The Carstairs family ring, he said. If you would.
She took it from him and slipped it onto her left ring finger, where it seemed to magically fit itself. She felt as if she ought to say something like, It's lovely, or thank you. But of course this wasn't a proposal, or even a gift. It was simply an acting prop.
Charlotte doesn't wear a wedding ring, she said. I hadn't realized Shadowhunters did.
We don't, said Will. It is customary to give a girl your family ring when you become engaged. But the actual wedding ceremony involves exchanging runes instead of rings. One on the arm, and one over the heart. Set me as a seal upon thine heart, as a seal upon thine arm, for love is strong as death. Jealousy is cruel as the grave, said Jem. Song of Solomon.
Jealousy is cruel as the grave? Tessa raised her eyebrows. That's not very romantic.
The coals thereof are coals of fire, which hath a most vehement flame, said Will, quirking his eyebrows up.
I always thought females found the idea of jealousy romantic. Men fighting over you. Well, there aren't any graves in mundane wedding ceremonies, said Tessa. Though your ability to quote the Bible is impressive. Better than my Aunt Harriet's. Did you hear that, James? She just compared us to her Aunt Harriet. Jem, as always, was unruffled.
We must be on familiar terms with all religious texts, he said. To us, they are instruction manuals.
So you memorized them all in school? She realized she had seen neither Will nor Jem at their studies since she had been at the Institute. Or rather, when you are tutored.
Yes, though Charlotte's rather fallen off in tutoring us lately, as you might imagine, said Will. One either has a tutor or one is schooled in Idris. That is, until you attain your majority at 18, which will be soon, thankfully, for the both of us.
Which one of you is older?
Jem,
said Will, and
I am, said Jem at the same time.
They laughed in unison as well, and Will added,
only by 3 months, though.
I knew you'd feel compelled to point that out, said Jem with a grin.
Tessa looked from one of them to the other. There could not be two boys who looked more different, or who had more different dispositions. And yet... Is that what it means to be parabatai? She said, finishing each other's sentences and the like, because there isn't much on it in the Codex. Will and Jem looked at each other. Will shrugged first, casually.
It is rather difficult to explain, he said, loftily. If you haven't experienced it, it...
I meant, Tessa said, you cannot, I don't know, read each other's minds or the like? Jem made a spluttering noise. Will's lambent blue eyes widened.
Read each other's minds? Horrors, no.
Then what's the point? You swear to guard each other, I understand that, but aren't all shadow hunters meant to do that for each other?
It's more than that,
said Jem, who had stopped spluttering and spoke somberly.
The idea of parabatai comes from an old tale, the story of Jonathan and David. And it came to pass that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant, because he loved him as his own soul. They were two warriors, and their souls were knit together by heaven. And out of that, Jonathan Shadowhunter took the idea of parabatai and encoded the ceremony into the law.
But it doesn't just have to be two men. It can be a man and a woman, or two women.
Of course, Jem nodded. You have only 18 years to find and choose a parabatai. Once you're older than that, the ritual is no longer open to you, and it is not merely a matter of promising to guard each other. You must stand before the council and swear to lay down your life for your parabatai. To go where they go, to be buried where they are buried. If there were an arrow speeding toward Will, I would be bound by oath to step in front of it.
Handy that, said Will. And he, of course, is bound to do the same for me, said Jem. Whatever he may say to the contrary, Will does not break oaths or the law.
He looked hard at Will, who smiled faintly and stared out the window.
Goodness, said Tessa.
That's all very touching, but I don't see exactly how it confers any advantages.
Not everyone has a parabatai, said Jem. Very few of us, actually, find one in the allotted time, but those who do can draw on the strength of their parabatai in battle. A rune put on you by your parabatai is always more potent than one you put on yourself, or one put on by another. And there are some runes we can utilize that no other shadow hunter can, because they draw on our double power.
But what if you decide that you don't want to be parabatai anymore? Tessa asked curiously. Can the ritual be broken?
Dear God, woman, said Will. Are there any questions you don't want to know the answer to?
I don't see the harm in telling her.
Jem's hands were folded atop his cane. The more she knows, the better she will be able to pretend she plans to ascend. He turned to Tessa.
The ritual cannot be broken save in a few situations. If one of us were to become a downworlder or a mundane, then the binding is cut. And of course, if one of us were to die, the other would be free. But not to choose another Parabatai, a single shadow hunter cannot take part in the ritual more than once.
It is like being married, isn't it? Said Tessa placidly. In the Catholic Church, like Henry VIII, he had to create a new religion just so he could escape from his vows.
Till death do us part,
said Will, his gaze still fixed on the countryside, speeding past outside the window.
Well, Will won't need to create a new religion just to be rid of me, said Jem. He'll be free soon enough.
Will looked over sharply, but it was Tessa who spoke.
Don't say that, she admonished Jem. A cure could still be found. I don't see any reason to abandon all hope.
She almost shrank back at the look Will bent on her, blue, blazing, and furious. Jem seemed not to notice as he replied, calmly and unaffectedly.
I haven't abandoned hope, he said. I just hope for different things than you do, Tessa Gray.
Hours went by after that. Hours during which Tessa nodded off, her head propped against her hand, the dull sound of the train's wheels winding its way into her dreams. She woke at last with Jem shaking her gently by the shoulders, the train whistle-blowing, and the guard shouting out the name of York Station. In a flurry of bags and hats and porters, they descended to the platform. It was nowhere near as crowded as King's Cross, and covered by a far more impressive arched glass and iron roof, through which could be glimpsed the grey-black sky. Platforms stretched as far as the eye could see. Tessa, Jem, and Will stood on the one closest to the main body of the station, where great gold-faced railway clocks proclaimed the time to be 6 o'clock. They were farther north now, and the sky had already begun to darken to twilight. They had only just gathered beneath one of the clocks when a man stepped out of the shadows. Tessa barely suppressed a start at the sight of him. He was heavily cloaked, wearing a black oilskin-looking hat, and boots like an old sailor. His beard was long and white, his eyes crested with thick white eyebrows. He reached out and laid a hand on Will's shoulder.
Nephilim, he said, his voice gruff and thickly accented. Is it you?
Dear God, said Will, putting his hand over his heart in a theatrical gesture. It's the ancient mariner who stoppeth one of three.
I'm here at the bequest of Aloysius Starkweather. I see the lads he wants or not. I've not got all night to stand about.
Important appointment with an albatross, Will inquired. Don't let us keep you. What my mad friend means to say, said Jem, is that we are indeed shadow hunters of the London Institute. Charlotte Branwell sent us. And you are?
Gutshill, the man said gruffly. My family's been serving the shadow hunters at the York Institute for nigh 3 centuries now. I can see through the glamours, the young ones. Save for this one, he added, and turned his eyes on Tessa. If there's a glamour on the girl, it's something I've never seen before.
She's a mundane, an ascendant, Jem said quickly. Soon to be my wife. He took Tessa's hand protectively, and turned it so that Gottschall could see the ring on her finger. The council thought it would be beneficial for her to see another institute besides London's.
Has Mr. Starkweather been told about this?
Gottschall asked. Black eyes keen beneath the rim of his hat.
It depends on what Mrs. Branwell told him, said Jem.
Well, I hope she told him something for your sakes, said the old servant, raising his eyebrows. If there's a man in Titworld who hates surprises more than Aloysius Starkweather, I've yet to meet the best beggar. Begging your pardon, miss.
Tessa smiled and inclined her head, but inside her stomach was churning. She looked from Jem to Will, but both boys were calm and smiling. They were used to this sort of subterfuge, she thought, and she was not. She had played parts before, but never as herself,
never wearing her own face and not someone else's. For some reason, the thought of lying without a false image to hide behind terrified her. She could only hope that Gottschall was exaggerating, though something, the glint in his eye as he regarded her, perhaps told her that he wasn't. Chapter 5 Shades of the Past. But evil things in robes of sorrow assailed the monarch's high estate. Ah, let us mourn, for never morrow shall dawn upon him desolate. And round about his home the glory that blushed and bloomed is but a dim remembered story of the old time entombed. Edgar Allan Poe, The Haunted Palace. Tessa barely noticed the interior of the station as they followed Starkweather's servant through its crowded entry hall. Hustle and bustle, people bumping into her, the smell of coal smoke and cooking food, blurring signs for the Great Northern Railway Company and the York and North Midland lines. Soon enough they were outside the station, under a graying sky that arched overhead, threatening rain. A grand hotel reared up against the twilight sky at one end of the station. Gottschall hurried them toward it, where a black carriage with the four C's of the clave painted on the door waited near the entrance. After settling the luggage and clambering inside, they were off, the carriage surging into Tanner Row to join the flow of traffic. Will was silent most of the way, drumming his slim fingers on his black trousered knees, his blue eyes distant and thoughtful. It was Jem who did the talking, leaning across Tessa to draw the curtains back on her side of the carriage. He pointed out items of interest, the graveyard where the victims of a cholera epidemic had been interred, and the ancient grey walls of the city rising up in front of them, crenellated across the top like the pattern on his ring. Once they were through the walls, the streets narrowed. It was like London, Tessa thought, but on a reduced scale. Even the stores they passed, a butcher's, a draper's, seemed smaller. The pedestrians, mostly men, who hurried by, chins dug into their collars to block the light rain that had begun to fall, were not as fashionably dressed. They looked country, like the farmers who came into Manhattan on occasion, recognizable by the redness of their big hands, the tough, sunburned skin off their faces. The carriage swung out of a narrow street and into the huge square. Tessa drew in a breath. Before them rose a magnificent cathedral, its Gothic turrets piercing the grey sky like St. Sebastian, stuck through with arrows. A massive limestone tower surmounted the structure, and niches along the front of the building held sculpted statues, each one different.
Is that the Institute? Goodness, it's so much grander than London's.
Will laughed. Sometimes a church is only a church, Tess.
That's York Minster, said Jem, pride of the city. Not the Institute. The Institute's in Good Ramgate Street.
His words were confirmed as the carriage swung away from the cathedral, down Deangate, and onto the narrow cobbled lane of Good Ramgate, where they rattled beneath a small iron gate between two leaning Tudor buildings. When they emerged on the other side of the gate, Tessa saw why Will had laughed. What rose before them was a pleasant enough looking church, surrounded by enclosing walls and smooth grass, but it had none of the grandeur of York Minster. When Gottschall came around to swing the door of the carriage open and help Tessa down to the ground, she saw that occasional headstones rose from the rain-dampened grass, as if someone had intended to begin a cemetery here, and had lost interest halfway through the proceedings. The sky was nearly black now, silvered here and there, with clouds made near transparent by starlight. Behind her, Jem's and Will's familiar voices murmured. Before her, the doors of the church stood open, and through them she could see flickering candles. She felt suddenly bodiless, as if she were the ghost of Tessa, haunting this odd place so far from the life she had known in New York. She shivered, and not just from the cold. She felt the brush of a hand against her arm, and warm breath stirred her hair. She knew who it was without turning.
"Shall we go in, my betrothed?"
Jem said softly in her ear. She could feel the laughter in him, vibrating through his bones, communicating itself to her. She almost smiled. "Let us beard the lion in his den together."
She put her hand through his arm. They made their way up the steps of the church. She looked back at the top and saw Will gazing up after them, apparently unheeding as Gottschall tapped him on the shoulder, saying something into his ear. Her eyes met his, but she looked quickly away. Entangling gazes with Will was confusing at best, dizzying at worst. The inside of the church was small and dark compared to the London Institutes. Pews dark with age ran the length of the walls, and above them witch-like tapers burned in holders made of blackened iron. At the front of the church, in front of a veritable cascade of burning candles, stood an old man dressed in Shadowhunter black. His hair and beard were thick and grey, standing out wildly around his head, his grey-black eyes half hidden beneath massive eyebrows, his skin scored with the marks of age. Tessa knew him to be almost 90, but his back was still straight, his chest as thick around as the trunk of a tree.
"Young Herondale, are you?" he barked as Will stepped forward to introduce himself. "Half mundane, half Welsh, and the worst traits of both, I've heard."
Will smiled politely.
"Diach!"
Starkweather bristled.
"Mongrel tongue,"
he muttered, and turned his gaze to Jem.
"James Carstairs," he said, "another Institute brat. I've half a mind to tell the lot of you to go to blazes. That upstart bit of a girl, that Charlotte Fairchild, foisting you all on me with an airy by your leave."
He had a little of the Yorkshire accent that his servant had, though much fainter. Still, the way he pronounced "I" did sound a bit like "ah."
"None of that family's ever had a bit of manners. I could do without a father, and I can do without..."
His flashing eyes came to rest on Tessa then, and he stopped abruptly, his mouth open as if he had been slapped in the face mid-sentence. Tessa glanced at Jem. He looked as startled as she did at Starkweather's sudden silence. But there, in the breach, was Will.
"This is Tessa Gray, sir," he said. "She is a mundane girl, but she is the betrothed of Carstairs here, and an ascendant."
"A mundane, you say?"
demanded Starkweather, his eyes wide.
"An ascendant," said Will, in his most soothing, silken voice. "She has been a faithful friend to the Institute in London, and we hope to welcome her into our ranks soon."
"A mundane," the old man repeated, and broke into a fit of coughing. "Well, times have, yes, I suppose then."
His eyes skipped across Tessa's face again, and he turned to Gottschall, who was looking martyred among the luggage.
"Get Cedric and Andrew to help you bring our guests' belongings up to their rooms," he said. "And do tell Ellen to instruct Cook to set 3 extra places for dinner tonight. I may have forgotten to remind her that we would have guests."
The servant gaped at his master before nodding in a seeming daze. Tessa couldn't blame him. It was clear that Starkweather had meant to send them packing and had changed his mind at the last moment. She glanced at Jem, who looked just as mystified as she felt. Only Will, blue eyes wide and face as innocent as a choir boy's, seemed as if he had expected nothing else.
"Well, come along then," said Starkweather gruffly without looking at Tessa. "You needn't stand there. Follow me and I'll show you to your rooms."
"By the angel," Will said, scraping his fork through the brownish mess on his plate. "What is this stuff?"
Tessa had to admit it was difficult to tell. Starkweather's servants, mostly bent old men and women, and a sour-faced female housekeeper, had done as he'd asked and had set 3 extra places for supper, which consisted of a dark, lumpy stew ladled out of a silver tureen by a woman in a black dress and white cap, so bent and old that Tessa had to physically prevent herself from leaping up to assist her with the serving. When the woman was done, she turned and shuffled off, leaving Jem, Tessa, and Will alone in the dining room to stare at one another across the table. A place had been set for Starkweather as well, but he wasn't at it. Tessa had to admit that if she were he, she wouldn't be rushing to eat the stew either. Heavy with overcooked vegetables and tough meat, it was even more unappetizing looking in the dim light of the dining room. Only a few tapers lit the cramped space. The wallpaper was dark brown,
the mirror over the unlit hearth stained and discolored. Tessa felt dreadfully uncomfortable in her evening dress, a stiff blue taffeta borrowed from Jessamine and let out by Sophie, which had turned to the color of a bruise in the unhealthy light. Still, it was awfully peculiar behavior for a host to be so insistent that they join him for supper and then not to appear. A servant just as frail and ancient as the one who ladled out the stew had led Tessa to her room earlier, a great dim cavern full of heavy carved furniture. It too was dimly lit, as if Starkweather were trying to save money on oil or tapers, though as far as Tessa knew, witch light cost nothing. Perhaps he simply liked the dark. She had found her room chilly, dark, and more than slightly ominous. The low fire burning in the grate had done little to warm the room. On either side of the hearth was carved a jagged lightning bolt. The same symbol was on the white pitcher full of chilly water that Tessa had used to wash her hands and face. She had dried off quickly, wondering why she couldn't remember the symbol from the codex. It must mean something important. The whole of the London Institute was decorated with Clave's symbols, like the angel rising from the lake, or the interlocked seas of council, covenant, Clave, and consul. Heavy old portraits were everywhere as well, in her bedroom, in the corridors, lining the staircase. After changing into evening dress and hearing the dinner bell ring, Tessa had made her way down the staircase, a great carved Jacobean monstrosity, only to pause on the landing to gaze at the portrait of a very young girl with long, fair hair dressed in an old-fashioned child's dress, a great ribbon surmounting her small head. Her face was thin and pale and sickly. Her eyes were bright, the only bright thing in this dark place, Tessa had thought. Adele Starkweather, had come a voice at her elbow, reading off the placard on the portrait's frame. 1842. She had turned to look at Will, who'd stood with his feet apart, his hands behind his back, gazing at the portrait and frowning. "What is it? You look as if you don't like her. But I rather do. She must be Starkweather's daughter. No, granddaughter, I think." Will had shaken his head, looking from the portrait to Tessa. "No doubt. This place is decorated like a family home. It is clear there have been Starkweathers in the York Institute for generations. You've seen the lightning bolts everywhere." Tessa had nodded. "That is the Starkweather family symbol. There is as much of the Starkweathers here as there is of the Clave. It is bad form to behave as if one owns a place like this. One cannot inherit an institute. The guardian of an institute is appointed by the consul. The place itself belongs to the Clave. Charlotte's parents ran the London Institute before she did. Part of the reason old Lightwood is so tender-tempered about the whole business," Will had replied. "Institutes aren't necessarily meant to stay in families, but the consul wouldn't have given Charlotte the post if he hadn't thought she was the right person for it. And it's only one generation. This..." He swept his arm about as if to encompass the portraits, the landing, and odd, lonely Aloysius Starkweather all in one gesture. "Well, no wonder the old man thinks he has the right to throw us out of the place." "Mad as hops," my aunt would have said. "Shall we go to dinner?" In a rare show of gentility, Will offered his arm. Tessa hadn't looked at him as she'd taken it. Will dressed for dinner was handsome enough to take away her breath, and she'd had the feeling she'd need her wits about her. Jem had already been waiting in the dining room when they'd arrived, and Tessa had settled herself beside him to await their host. His place had been set, his plate filled with stew, even his wine glass filled with dark red wine, but there had been no sign of him. It was Will who had shrugged first and begun to eat, though he'd soon looked as if he'd wished he hadn't. "What is this?" he went on now, spearing an unfortunate object on a fork and raising it to eye level. This thing. "A parsnip?" Jem suggested. "A parsnip planted in Satan's own garden," said Will. He glanced about. "I don't suppose there's a dog I could feed it to. There don't seem to be any pets around." Jem, who loved all animals, even the inglorious and ill-tempered church, observed. "Probably all poisoned by parsnips," said Will.
Oh, dear, Tessa said sadly, laying her fork down. And I was so hungry, too.
There's always the dinner rolls, said Will, pointing to a covered basket. Though I warn you, they're as hard as stones. You could use them to kill black beetles, if any beetles bother you in the middle of the night.
Tessa made a face and took a swig of her wine. It was as sour as vinegar.
Will set his fork down and began cheerfully, in the manner of Edward Lear's Book of Nonsense.
There once was a lass from New York, who found herself hungry in York. But the bread was like rocks, the parsnips shaped like...
You can't rhyme York with York,
interrupted Tessa.
It's cheating.
She's right, you know, said Jim, his delicate fingers playing with the stem of his wine glass. Especially with fork, being so obviously the correct choice.
Good evening.
The hulking shadow of Aloysius Starkweather loomed up suddenly in the doorway.
Tessa wondered with a flush of embarrassment how long he'd been standing there.
Mr. Herondale, Mr. Carstairs, Miss,
Gray, Tessa said. Theresa Gray.
Indeed.
Starkweather made no apologies, just settled himself heavily at the head of the table.
He was carrying a square flat box, the sort bankers used to keep their papers in, which he sat down beside his plate.
With a flash of excitement, Tessa saw there was a year marked on it, 1825. And even better, three sets of initials. JTS, AES, AHM.
No doubt your young miss will be pleased to know. I've buckled to her demands and searched the archives all day and half last night besides.
Starkweather began in an aggrieved tone. It took Tessa a moment to realize that in this case, young miss meant Charlotte.
It's lucky, she is, that my father never threw anything out. And the moment I saw the papers, I remembered.
He tapped his temple.
89 years, and I never forget a thing. You tell old Whelan that when he talks about replacing me.
We surely will, sir, said Jem, his eyes dancing.
Starkweather took a hearty gulp of his wine and made a face.
By the angel, that stuff's disgusting.
He set the glass down and began pulling papers from the box. What we have here is an application for reparations on behalf of two warlocks, John and Anne Shade, a married couple.
Now, here's the odd bit,
the old man went on.
The filing was done by their son, Axel Hollingworth Mortmain, 22 years old. Now, of course, warlocks are barren.
Will shifted uncomfortably in his seat, his eyes slanting away from Tessa's. This son was adopted, said Jem.
Shouldn't be allowed that, said Starkweather,
taking another slug of the wine he had pronounced disgusting. His cheeks were beginning to redden.
Like giving a human child to wolves to raise, before the accords.
If there are any clues to his whereabouts, said Jem, gently trying to steer the conversation back onto its track, we have very little time.
Very well, snapped Starkweather.
There's little information about your precious Mortmain in here, more about the parents. It seems suspicion fell on them when it was discovered that the male warlock, John Shade, was in possession of the Book of the White. Quite a powerful spellbook, you understand. Disappeared from the London Institute's library under suspicious circumstances back in 1752. The book specializes in binding and unbinding spells, tying the soul to the body, or untying it, as the case may be. Turned out the warlock was trying to animate things. He was digging up corpses or buying them off medical students and replacing the more damaged bits with mechanisms. Then trying to bring them to life. Necromancy. Very much against the law. And we didn't have the accords in those days. An enclave group swept in and slaughtered both warlocks.
And the child, said Will. Mortmain?
No hide, no hair of them. Said Starkweather. We searched, but nothing. Assumed he was dead till his turned up. Cheeky as you please. Demanding reparations. Even his address.
His address? Will demanded. That information had not been included in the scroll they had seen at the Institute. In London.
Nay, right here in Yorkshire.
Starkweather tapped the page with a wrinkled finger.
Ravenscar Manor,
A massive old pile up north from here. Been abandoned now, I think, for decades. Now that I think about it, can't figure out how he could have afforded it in the first place. It's not where the Sheards lived.
Still, Jem said, an excellent starting point for us to go looking. If it's been abandoned since his tenancy, there may be things he left behind. In fact, he may well still be using the place.
I suppose.
Starkweather sounded unenthusiastic about the whole business.
Most of the Sheards' belongings were taken for spoils.
Spoils? Tessa echoed faintly.
She remembered the term from the Codex.
Anything a Shadow Hunter took from a downworlder who had been caught breaking the law belonged to him. Those were the spoils of war.
She looked across the table at Jem and Will, Jem's gentle eyes resting on her with concern, Will's haunted blue ones holding all their secrets.
Did she really belong to a race of creatures that was at war with what Jem and Will were?
Spoils, Starkweather rumbled.
He had polished off his wine and started on Will's untouched glass.
Do those interest you, gal? We've quite a collection here in the Institute.
Puts the London collection to shame.
Or so I'm told.
He stood up, nearly knocking over his chair.
Come along. I'll show them to you, and tell you the rest of this sorry tale, though there's not that much more to it.
Tessa looked quickly to Will and Jem for a cue, but they were already on their feet, following the old man out of the room. Starkweather spoke as he walked, his voice drifting back over his shoulder, making the rest of them hurry to match his long strides.
Never thought much of this reparations business myself, he said as they passed down another dimly lit, interminably long stone corridor. Makes downworlders uppity, thinking they have a right to get something out of us. All of the work we do and no thanks, just hands held out for more, more, more. Don't you think so, gentlemen?
Bastards, all of them, said Will, who seemed as if his mind were 1,000 miles away.
Jem looked at him sideways.
Absolutely, barked Starkweather, clearly pleased. Not that one should use such language in front of a lady, of course. As I was saying, this Mortmain was protesting the death of Anne Sheard, the male warlock's wife. Said she had nothing to do with her husband's projects, hadn't known about them, he claimed. Her death was undeserved. Wanted a trial of those guilty of what he called murder and his parents' belongings back.
Was the Book of the White among what he asked for? Jem inquired. I know it's a crime for a warlock to own such a volume.
It was. It was retrieved and placed in the London Institute Library, where no doubt it remains still. Certainly no one was going to give it to him.
Tessa did a quick mental calculation in her head. If he was 89 now, Starkweather would have been 26 at the time of the Shade's death. Were you there?
His bloodshot eyes danced over her. She noticed that even now, a little drunk, he didn't seem to want to look at her too directly.
Well, was I where?
You said an enclave group was sent out to deal with the Shades. Were you among them?
He hesitated, then shrugged. Aye, he said, his Yorkshire accent thickening for a moment. Didn't take long to get the both of them. They weren't prepared. Not a bit. I remember them lying there in their blood. The first time I saw dead warlocks, I was surprised they bled red. I could have sworn it'd be another colour, blue or green or some such. He shrugged. We took the cloaks off them, like skins off a tiger. I was given the keeping of them, or more rightly my father was. Glory, glory. Those were the days.
He grinned like a skull, and Tessa thought of Bluebeard's chamber, where he kept the remains of the wives he had killed. She felt both very hot and very cold all over. Mortmain never had a chance, did he? She said quietly. Filing his complaint like that, he was never going to get his reparations.
Of course not, barked Starkweather. Rubbish, all of it. Claiming the wife wasn't involved. What wife isn't neck deep in her husband's business? Besides, he wasn't even their blood son. Couldn't have been. Probably more of a pet to them than anything else. I'd wager the father would have used him for spare parts if it came down to it. He was better off without them. He should have been thanking us, not asking for a trial.
The old man broke off as he reached a heavy door at the end of the corridor and put his shoulder to it, grinning down at them from beneath beetling brows.
Have you ever been to the Crystal Palace?
Well, this is even better.
He shouldered the door open, and light blazed up around them as they passed through into the room beyond. Clearly, it was the only well-lit room in the place. The room was full of glass-fronted cabinets, and over each cabinet was a mounted lamp of witchlight, illuminating the contents within. Tessa saw Will's back stiffen, and Jem reached for her, his hand tightening on her arm with an almost bruising grip.
"Don't," he began.
But she had pushed forward and was staring at the contents of the cabinets.
Spoils. A gold locket, open to a daguerreotype of a laughing child. The locket was splattered with dried blood. Behind her, Starkweather was talking about digging the silver bullets out of the bodies of freshly killed werewolves and melting them down to recast. There was a dish of such bullets, in fact, in one of the cabinets, filling a bloodstained bowl. Sets of vampire fangs, row and row of them. What looked like sheets of gossamer or delicate fabric pressed under glass. Only on closer inspection did Tessa realize they were the wings of fairies. A goblin, like the one she had seen with Jessamine in Hyde Park, floating open-eyed in a large jar of preservative fluid. And the remains of warlocks. Mummified, taloned hands, like Mrs. Black's. A stripped skull, utterly defleshed, human-looking, save that it had tusks instead of teeth. Vials of sludgy-looking blood.